Guys, today I have a guest that I'm selfishly bringing on because I want to know everything about this area. And this is intellectual property defense, but not only defense, it's offense, okay? And Hilton Hart, co-founder and CEO of Edison Law. The reason I know about this man is because I had a friend introduce me to his company, and they've literally gotten us back tens of thousands of dollars, and soon it'll pass $100,000, I believe, in money back from people who are literally trying to taking our intellectual property, okay, with no grounds, and doing so, they think, with full indemnity and having no liability. But Hilton here is leading the charge to take back the rights that we have in the United States for our own images, our trademarks, our copyrights. And so anyway, I have with me Hilton. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. You know a ton about what I do, so this should be really interesting.
Absolutely. So let's just, I guess I want to start off with the story. With the story of like, how did this even happen? Are you even a lawyer? I don't think you're a lawyer, but I don't know. Like, explain to me how this Edison Law thing came about.
I'm not an attorney and my company's not a law firm. But just to get into the story first, my brother Molson Hart, pretty kind of well known on Twitter. Some of you might know him. He has a toy brand, and a specific brand named Brainflakes. And yep. His product was being heavily counterfeited back in 2016. And so he discovered an incredible legal strategy that helped him stop those counterfeiters. He spent about $8,000 on legal fees that year, and he stopped 23 counterfeiters, relatively small lawsuit for what we're used to, but his lawsuit collected over $120,000. So wow. Not only did he solve his IP issue, he 10 times his money in the process. It blew his mind, and he thought, you know, why don't we help every other company selling in e-commerce to do the same thing? And so that was how Edison was born. And he kind of hooked up with me. I'm a former software engineer, to kind of build the technology and help scale the business and do as many of these lawsuits as possible, really.
That's amazing. And so to do this, this is primarily copyright infringement, or the one that Molson started with, that lawsuit, is that all about copyright, or was there other intellectual property defended there?
No, his very first lawsuit only included trademark claims. So it was really? just the text Brainflakes. And then over the course of the few years, we figured out how to kind of modify this legal strategy to also protect copyrights, which could be an image or a block of text. And also we're extending it now to enforce patents, mainly design patents, but we're working on utility patents as well.
That is brilliant. Okay. And just, I know this is maybe, again, you're not a lawyer, you're not an attorney. However, I'm sure you have a pretty good knowledge about this. Could you explain to people, like, what is a copyright specifically? Because, again, for my, the lawsuit that we did, I think was primarily copyright. People do use their name, but generally trademarks are easier to enforce, at least on Amazon, very easy to enforce. Right. But, like, what is a copyright, and where do your rights extend to your knowledge, knowing this is not legal advice?
Well, so for those three types of IP, there's two parts of the government. There's the Copyright Office, and then there's combined the Patent and Trademark Office.
Okay.
Now, those are three different things, but the confusing part is each type of IP can actually overlap. So some design patents can be similar to a trademark, because you can trademark a design in a way. So, you know, they overlap. So we can just go through each of them very quickly. A trademark is either a logo, like a designed graphic, or it's a word or a set of words. And the objective of a trademark is to indicate the origin of goods and services. Mm-hmm. So when someone sees Zule on a product, they know that the company that Aaron Cordova has started or runs, you know, that product came from them. And that's the responsibility of that type of IP. Next, you have copyright. it's less about the origin and good origin of goods and services. It's just more about people knowing truly who owns the rights to the image or the text that was written. And so that's a copyright. And then finally, you have patents. There's two different types of patents. You have design, which protects what the product looks like, and it's the non-functional components.
Mm-hmm.
And then a utility patent protects the functional components. So we could go into some examples. Zulay is a trademark. The word
or Zulay. We say Zulay, but a lot of people Zulay. Say Zulay. It's
acceptable. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Yeah, Zulay. Yeah. So Zulay. The Zulay. It's again. It comes back the brand name. The trademark is the brand. Yeah. Essentially, it's like coming from the cow. You know that Mr. Smith's farm, his cows are amazing, and he puts the brand on it with Smith on it, and you know it's his cow from his farm. So if someone else used that brand on a crappy cow, it's diluting his own trust and reputation, because whenever you put the brand Smith on it, it should mean that it's a good cow because Smith is a good, trustworthy farmer, right?
Right.
So that's trademark, right? And now on trademark, or again, we call it brand, but like obviously the legal term is the trademark. But in copyright, you said it's to know who is the rights owner. Could you clarify that? Because it's not who created it, right? Because I guess if I'm an employee and I create an image for a company, I'm not the copyright owner. It would be the company I'm working for, I guess. Is that why you specify it like that?
Exactly. So you could have hired a photographer to take pictures of your products. And as long as the photographer is okay with it, they can transfer ownership or rights to those photos over to you. And then your company would then have the ability to prevent others from using those images or copyrights. But it could be the same thing as you maybe employed a third party or an employee contractor to write the description for your products or the text that's on the back of your packaging, especially if it's very unique and really is custom and describes your product in detail. So that'd be another type of copyright and thing you could protect and prevent other people from using.
Okay. And this is an interesting topic, but what about AI? I'm sure you're getting into this AI, but like if you use, Midjourney or something and you get that thing to make you told it to do something, you make this image, who the hell owns the copyright at that point? Like when you get into that aspect, who owns the copyright?
I haven't spent as much time thinking about that. But I think here are the two tests that I would use. So first of all, the AI that you used to generate that content or those images, did you create the AI that helped you create that content? Because if you did, then you would have a much better claim because you created the AI. And if the AI created the image, you could say that, it should be more so yours. The next thing is how much of the image is custom and the input of how that image looked came from you, right? If you gave it extremely detailed input and it came out with a very custom image that looked exactly the way you suggested, I would say that that's a great test to use to say that image is more so yours than a computer's. You know, if you just said, show me a beautiful garlic press and it creates a cool one, but none of it came that those ideas and everything about it was from your input, then I would say it's more so the property of the AI or no one's property, really.
Right. Okay. And then, okay. So fine. One last thing you're saying about the design patents. Okay. So in the design patent, let's say you use Midjourney or you had a factory, you had something off the shelf. How much, and again, maybe you know this, maybe you don't, but how much do you have to edit of that image to make it now, let's say, unique? Because really, let's say a lemon squeezer, man. Lemon squeezer looks like a lemon squeezer. Like the base, they're going to look about the same. But like if I make it, I don't know, I put little things on it. How much do I have to change it from an existing thing? Whether it's from AI or from another person or a different design, how much do you change it to say, good, this is my change now and it's my design?
Mm-hmm. Well, you need to be really careful with respect to patents because a patent can have many claims. And to be infringing on the patent, you just need to infringe on one claim. Mm. Whereas the test for something like copyright infringement, it just has to be like substantially different and there needs to have been significant changes to it to like make it your own, if that makes sense. So yeah, it just really depends. I hate to say that, but that is how it is.
So the patent, if you violate one line of the patent, then your product is in full violation.
Exactly.
Interesting. And then does this like patent office really review every single line and say, hey, if I grant you this patent, every single line is unique, and I'm saying that all of that is an invention of yours, even if it's 300 lines, like, do they even look through that?
Yeah, they try. They do their best. They're supposed to. But I don't know how thorough they are. I wouldn't want to say they're very thorough. And then one really difficult thing about the past couple of years, especially post-COVID, is that there is an overwhelmingly large increase in people in China trying to register intellectual property. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, they're assuming the IP they came up with is their own ideas and inventions. And I think it's really overwhelming the USPTO, Patent and Trademark Office. I think I saw an article a year or two ago. It was something like 75%, you know, 3/4 of the trademarks filed were by Chinese-based companies in like 21 or 22. So yeah, they just, you know, I don't know whether they've increased the amount of resources and people they have to review all these things and make sure there's no prior work or...
I know for sure that they don't check for all the prior work, because I know patents that a product is selling 2018 and then the patent is filed in 2021 and then it gets approved in 2022, even though the exact same thing was already for sale for 3 years. And it's very easily clearly seen on Amazon. So I think the prior art part, I don't think they look for that. They might look through, I don't know. It doesn't seem like they do it very well, at least from what I've seen.
They definitely do not. But, you know, I don't know whether they say this to reduce their liability or whatever, but they do say that it's also the responsibility of the filer to do their own due diligence. So there's that.
That's true. So what about taking it down? So I know that, again, I think I might have, this is maybe not what you guys do, but still, I don't know. I'm just curious about it. Like, if you know someone that did it falsely, that they've been selling it for 3 years, then they file a patent, is there a way to take that thing down and say, sorry, you have a fake patent? Or if they take my listing down, because it's happened before, they take down my listing, and I know it's a patent is not valid. Like, can I counteract that? Or can you guys help me with that, since we already work together?
My company does not work on patent invalidations, but you can certainly have a patent invalidated. Or, you know, if they submit that your product listing is infringing on their patent, you're able to talk to the marketplace or the third party, whatever, that accepted that report and try to convince them that you're not infringing. But, you know, I'm sure, you know, like,
hasn't worked really, but
yeah, the marketplaces ultimately don't care. Anything, they don't want to take down products at all. They, you know, they want as much gross merchandise value on their platform. They want to collect a percentage of every sale, whether it's counterfeit product, dangerous product, you name it.
Okay. Okay, so then I guess let's circle back to really Edison. Okay, so Molson did this, you know, $8,000, you know, more than 10x's money on people getting that trademark. So then how do you come into the picture and how has your success been so far?
Myself coming into the picture or? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
So, I mean, back in 2018, I wrote some software where I took every trademark that was in the USPTO database and I wrote some software to search that on Amazon. And then I had an algorithm which analyzed the results that came up to try to identify if there was a significant amount of infringement for each trademark. And so that's how we basically got started. We just called and emailed every company that we could find that had lots of infringement. To help them do that legal strategy that we talked about. So now we're helping our customers sue over 30,000 counterfeiters per year. So that's like could be 30,000 Amazon stores. And we've built tons of proprietary software to help us gather the evidence for the lawsuits, software like a CRM type system to help the law firm manage the hundreds of counterfeiters in every case. We've had to hire people outside the United States that are lawyers straight out of college at a, you know, a cost-effective rate. It's been a wild ride for the past 4 or 5 years.
Nice. And do you have a total number of money you've gotten back from infringers?
I think the last I looked a week or two ago, and it was around a little over $65 million.
Woo!
So our customers actually got paid between almost 40% of that. So we're providing an incredible amount of value for our customers. I have a good example that you might appreciate. I saw one of your other videos where you were talking about margins in a business. It's not directly correlated to what you're saying, but one of my customers, we paid him $50,000 from the lawsuit, which is not that much money compared to most of our lawsuits. But he explained that a 5% margin, he would have had to sell $1 million worth of toys to get that amount of profit that we sent his company from the lawsuit. And that was one of our earlier customers. And it just, you know, it blew my mind the effect that we can have on businesses, stopping the counterfeiters and getting them some money.
That's amazing. So you literally have paid out something like $30 million, you know, over $20 million to people that literally is pure cash. And so I guess I should ask you, but I'm excited to tell people about it, that like, you don't have to pay anything to get started. But let's hear from you. Like, and I've heard, I clarified with you on X, right, or Twitter, which is you'll take any size case or any size brand. And if a person sells on Amazon, how would they go ahead and work with you? Oh, of course, I guess if there's any sort of a commission, maybe I should have like an email or something, like a landing page. Anyway, but let's say someone wants to work with you, like, how do they actually work with Edison to get back money from people that are basically stealing their intellectual property?
That's a great question. We actually have tried to make the process as turnkey as possible. So literally, if you just contact us on our website, we'll review your infringement for free. We'll tell you how much is out there. We'll tell you a rough estimate of what we think we could, how much money we could collect from the counterfeiters. You know, as you mentioned, we only earn 40% of the money that we collect in the lawsuit. The law firm that we partner with would earn 20%, but we don't charge you anything out of pocket. And in our typical case, in order to execute it, we have to spend between $10,000 and $20,000 in advance, like a year up before we receive any money. So, in terms of the turnkey nature of it, we do all of the research. We find all of the infringement. We gather all of the evidence ourselves. We provide it to the law firm. We're your interface with the law firm, so you don't have to answer 1,000 questions and explain things. We even help make sure that we can maximize every settlement negotiation. So we provide recommendations to the law firms and kind of train them on how to best negotiate with, you know, a counterfeiter in China, for example, and what their psychology is. You know, we help them understand the value of $10,000 into an Amazon account. You know, the account's clearly worth much more than just the money inside of it. You know, we have to kind of, we're the liaison and we help the law firms really maximize the money that can be collected in the case. So we're happy to have a customer be very involved, and help us and give us their perspective. And they always have full control in these lawsuits. But we really try to make it the entire case turnkey. If you're comfortable with it, we'll sign you up. We'll take your counterfeiters down, and a year and a half later, we'll send you, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars. So it can be anywhere in that spectrum.
And so in your case, I think in mine, when we worked with you guys, it was not over a trademark. I think it was just copyright. So how do you have different cases, or you do one bundle case, or generally how does that work in terms of like taking down people and infringers?
Your case was mostly copyright infringement. If I remember correctly, there was some trademark infringement.
Okay.
So it's a lot easier to enforce a single product type or at least a single brand. Because when you sue hundreds of Amazon stores in a single lawsuit, you know, the judge is going to say, well, why did you include all these guys together? You know, how do we know they didn't infringe in different ways, or the facts in the lawsuit are different? So we do our best to make the legal action as efficient as possible and include as many counterfeiters in one case. And, you know, what they're really counterfeiting claims. So what we mean by that is, you know, someone can counterfeit by using your image and making customers think that they're buying an authentic Zulai garlic mm-hmm. press, for example. Or clearly, if they're using your trademark, that would be similar or even more egregious. So we can enforce trademarks, copyrights, and patents all in a single case. Mm-hmm. It's just better that there's a good story, the case is focused. But that doesn't prevent us from targeting hundreds of sellers.
Okay. And then I want to get into this copyright issue, because I believe there is a bit of, I just got a takedown on one of my own products. So we have a product, and I guess the image format, this is a normal kitchen product, and it had just a similar composition of the image, but really it's a bundle of three and they're just next to each other. Okay. And it looks similar to one of the top sellers, and Amazon took it down and they filed a DMCA complaint, which I don't think is appropriate, because we took our own pictures. The composition was similar. Now, anyway, in this case, I'm like, in theory, the infringer. Amazon believes I'm an infringer. Okay, fine. The image was up for like a day and it was taken down. It's like, okay, fine. We'll change the composition. No big deal. However, I don't know. Like, I wasn't part of this exact scenario. I didn't make this image. I didn't direct it. But it did happen where ours image had a similar composition as someone else. Now, in this case, people might think, well, you're definitely not infringing on anything because you took your own pictures and that's it. Now, what does the law say in terms of that copyright and like recreating? Because again, when I was working with you guys, it's the first time I ever heard of this concept. I was literally totally ignorant to it. How does a copyright work in terms of original image, like a pixel by pixel copy, and then a sort of recreation?
Mm-hmm. So that's a really complicated gray area. You need to be careful. But yeah, let's go through it. So if you were a cell phone manufacturer, and Apple takes a lot of pictures of their phone and the phone is looking you straight in the face. Mm-hmm. And their phone is a rectangle with rounded edges. There should be nothing preventing you from selling a non-Apple phone where the customer sees a picture with the phone looking straight at them and it's a square or a rectangle with rounded corners, right? So, you know, Apple might argue that you're recreating their picture, but in reality, there's really only so many ways you can take pictures of a phone. Mm-hmm. And so I would argue that is not copyright infringement. So
in the case of a phone just right. standing, but what about, let's say you're selling this hand, you know, this microphone stand, and it's extended this way and it has a microphone here, and someone else has a stand and it's a different shape, but it has that angle, mm-hmm. right? Or maybe it's facing the exact like 38 degrees and a half angle with this much of a tilt. I mean, and then right. someone recreates it. And let's say they really did recreate it. Like, let's say they saw the image and I'm going to say, I'm going to make an image just like that. Mm-hmm. What if they did recreate it and put it, but like still, there's only so many angles you're going to have. So right. when do you say, hey, I mean, and there's obviously your case. And then of course, at the end of the day, I think it's the judge decides if you even take it to court, but like how often does it go to court, or how do you settle it? Like what's that process look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, for the first part, it depends. What's more important is how unique your picture or the orientation of that microphone is, but not how specific, right? So if you take a photo of a microphone that's at a 38 degree angle, you don't just now own pictures of microphones at 38 degree angles right, that look similar. Right. But if you did something very special with the way the shadow and the lighting hits the microphone, and you took the picture at a certain angle and you could see a person's hands in it, you know, manipulating it, you know, those are things that make your copyright or your image more unique and more protectable. So that's the way I'd look at it. As far as damages and how are those disputes resolved in court? Well, by the way, we never really, in our kinds of cases, everything's negotiated and settled over email. So you don't have to worry about, you don't have to go to trial over a dispute like this, which is very time consuming and expensive. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to the damages. It always comes down to actual damages or statutory. So a statute is like statutory damages would be a fixed amount. So if you infringe on someone's trademark, and it's willful, the maximum could be, I don't remember the numbers exactly, $200,000 in damages owed to the trademark owner. I think the copyright could be like 30,000 or something like that.
Okay.
So those are those fixed amounts. You get to decide whichever is more appropriate, statutory or actual damages.
You mean the plaintiff, right? The plaintiff decides.
Yes, the plaintiff. Well, I mean, you're making your case to the judge, really.
Okay.
But yeah. So actual damages, unfortunately, will be the profit that the other person generated from the use of those of the materials, the image in this case.
Well, the infringer. It's not the loss from the original person. It's actually the profit the other guy made.
Right. Yes. And that it works that way for copyrights and patents. Okay. So you can imagine if someone posted an image of yours on their blog and they don't monetize their blog, they didn't make any money from the blog. It's hard to say that there were really any damages. Right. Yep. Whereas trademarks, they're way more powerful and you get much more protection. It would be your loss, the brand owner's lost profits.
Okay.
We should probably come up with a chart for all of this. It also matters, you know, when the infringement occurred. Did it occur before or after registration and things like that? And copyrights, trademarks, and design patents all have their quirks with respect to that. It's sort of like a calculus or, you know, a formula along with some interpretation of the law to kind of really hone in and figure out, you know, what kind of liability the infringer has.
Okay. And right now with the cases they're working on, okay, and I'll give a bit of a recap. You guys focus mostly on overseas infringers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so people who are not in the United States who are infringing. And from until I met you guys, I thought that these guys were basically free of all liability. Because you cannot take them to court. That's what I really thought, like, someone has a shell company out in China or wherever, like, you know, India or Bangladesh or whatever. And you sue them for a trademark. You can't even find the entity. You can't even, like, figure out who it is. And then to get them to show up in court, it's practically an impossibility. So I always thought that these guys had pretty much zero risk for infringing, and that's why it was so common, because they could get away with murder, so to speak, and never get taken to court, because you have to bring someone across the country to show up in the court case. I don't think they show up. And so how do you get around the fact that these people are nowhere to be found? They will not show up to court. How do you get around that?
Mm-hmm. Well, so the first part is we were trying to solve a problem that wasn't solved. So I think everyone knows how to, if you're based in California, how to sue a guy in New York. And, mm-hmm. you know, we weren't trying to solve that problem. No one really needed our help to do that. So we figured out how to sue counterfeiters that are based outside of the country and collect money from them. That was like the key part. The way we did that is we use a federal court order, which freezes the money in their e-commerce store. Mm-hmm. So the money that you can't distribute every 2 weeks or a month and a half, depending on the marketplace, we actually get the ability to prevent them from pulling that money out. Mm-hmm. On top of that, during the litigation or negotiation phase, if they keep operating their business, which of course they want to do, that money will accumulate and no more money is allowed to be distributed from the account without the judge's approval or the plaintiff's. Mm-hmm. So we were able to get leverage against someone that's based in China through their US e-commerce store or payment processors like PayPal and Stripe and things like that. So I kind of lost my train of thought.
Yeah,
there.
No. You freeze them with a federal court order, right? And so what does that mean, federal court? You're not suing them like in the state of California or state of Texas or state of Florida. This is federal. So how do you even sue somebody? What kind of court is that?
Ah, great. So we sue them in federal court, and because they're not based in any particular state and they're outside of the country, and they're operating their business on the internet and they're selling products to many states throughout the country, it effectively gives you the ability to sue them wherever you want. Mm-hmm. So we because we're suing in federal court and it's federal law, it's the same everywhere. But we particularly file cases in three different states because, well, they're big states and with a lot of economic activity, with a lot of judges, but also because the judges in those states have seen these kinds of cases and they understand e-commerce, they understand foreign-based counterfeiters. And so, you know, it's just nice to have a judge see our case that's seen many before it that are very similar. And it really streamlines the process and things move pretty quickly. You know, our lawsuits still take a year to a year and a half, but relative to other types of litigation, that's very fast.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, actually, because it does take quite a bit of time. Like, why does it take so long? Mm-hmm.
Well, we can go through the process. It probably takes us a month or two just to gather all the evidence necessary, have the law firm review it. So once they file the case, it could take the judge 2 weeks or, you know, 2 months just to schedule a hearing. These judges are very busy. They've got a lot of other important things, like especially criminal cases. Like, you know, it could be between your trademark case and a violent murderer's case, you know, so there's a queue. The judges, it seems like they're overworked. I'm surprised that we haven't been adding as many federal judges as other government jobs lately. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, every step of the way, there's always about a month or two lag. And you want to give the defendants an opportunity to take their time and have the right strategy, talk to their attorneys. So, you know, everyone's given enough time to basically execute whatever they need to in the case. Another part is that when you sue hundreds of counterfeiters, the judge wants you to make your best effort to settle with as many of them as possible outside of the court.
Yeah.
Because the court views it as, you know, why use the taxpayer resources when this is potentially something that you could resolve between yourselves out of the court's eyes.
So wait, this is before they freeze the accounts. They're just saying like, go solve it before the account gets frozen. Or this after?
Well, technically that's true. So the judge wants you to explain, what did you try to do before even filing this lawsuit? And we'll tell the judge, oh, we've been submitting takedown requests for years. Or, you know, we catch someone using our trademark and then they just go and use our images. So you need to communicate to the judge that the federal courts was the last effort. And you've made a lot of effort in advance of taking taxpayer dollars.
Yeah, because I mean, you could email them, but that's not going to do absolutely anything.
Exactly.
I mean, you email them, like, what are they going to do? They say, yeah, take us down.
Right? Screw you. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Or you could tip them off, you know, which you definitely don't want to do, right? You really want to catch these people by surprise with your particularly legal strategy. But back to the court. So after you settle with as many counterfeiters as possible, then you can go back
before
to the judge
frozen.
And say...
Before the freezing.
No. You freeze their money. That's how you get leverage over them.
Okay.
And then you try to settle.
Okay. So they're saying, hey, we'll freeze the accounts and then you go and settle. Kind of something like
exactly.
that?
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. So then once you're finished settling with everyone, the judge wants you to come back and say, you know, this list of defendants, these 30%, they just didn't respond or we couldn't come to an agreement. And then he or she will grant you a judgment. And so, you know, it could be just a flat amount across the board. Okay, go and collect $100,000 from each of their accounts. Or it could be something like, you know, show me an equitable accounting, meaning like, tell me how many lost profits each one of them caused you, or how much profits they generated, depending on the IP. And you can go and collect that money from them. So that, you know, there's just a lot of steps to the process and there's time between each step. And so that's how we're able to do these lawsuits in about a year. If you were to go to trial and have a jury and experts, I mean, it could be years before something's resolved.
Yeah. And then there's no need to do that. And these guys won't even show up probably. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause that's the guys that didn't settle. They didn't even respond. So there's no way, like if you have a court date, they're going to show up and not show up. I mean, they won't even be there. So, yeah, take the money out of the accounts. It sounds like the reasonable thing to do.
Right. And what's really interesting about counterfeiters based in China or Asia is, you know, when you have leverage over them, they are very settlement oriented and deal oriented, negotiation oriented, which is nice because they're not as litigious. They really like to do a deal, resolve the situation. It's just that you kind of have to get a hold of them in order to get them to do that. Whereas like, you know, I've seen some Americans that are infringing be completely irrational in ways that I would never expect a counterfeiter in China to act. And so you'll have a bad time suing Americans unless you have a ton of damages on your side to kind of collect from them and use as leverage in the event that you win the lawsuit.
Okay. And these infringers, right? I'm assuming, right? And I don't know if you've tried to go after this kind of angle, I guess. But if they're taking Zulai, right? They're taking Zulai Kitchen's images. More than likely, they're also taking, I don't know, Cuisinart, right? Or whatever, OXO. And not only that, but probably also Samsung. And like, so like, do you have these, some infringers just show up case after case? And then is there anything you can do about those guys?
We do. We frequently see the same counterfeiters counterfeiting multiple of our clients. Unfortunately, there's really nothing in our legal system that kind of like in civil matters is there to disincentivize you from making the same, committing the same civil, it's not a crime, I guess, over and over again. So unfortunately, yeah, they're outside of the financial incentive of, man, every time I counterfeit someone, they take, you know, $10,000 from me. Outside of that disincentive, there's nothing in there to really prevent them from repetitively infringing on different brands.
Okay, so counterfeiting somebody's trademark and stuff, that's not a criminal offense. What is a criminal offense? Like if you actually counterfeit produce a product with the logo on it, is that criminal or?
I'm not as clear on this. I actually think that maybe willful infringement of IP is a criminal offense, but what's more important is who the plaintiff is. So if the government is suing you or coming after you for breaking a law, I would, you know, say that that's much more so considered a criminal offense. So obviously, you know, theft, like felonies, you know, violence, things like that.
Interesting. Okay. And so, okay, fine. So they just repeat over and over and somehow they just get away with it. It's crazy. So anyway, I just want to thank you for the work you guys are doing because I know that it's protecting brands all over the place, right? Here in the United States where people are coming in, violating the laws, thinking they're going to get away with it. But now they know that Edison is there. And hopefully some of these guys have stopped. I mean, I know you have repeating, but maybe some people, like after they do it one time, they maybe give up. I don't know.
Right. I think we're doing a great job. We're educating counterfeiters that they shouldn't counterfeit. But the issue is that there's just billions of people in manufacturing countries that are, whoa, there's a huge bug in my room. Excuse me. It's one of those like male mosquitoes with the really long legs.
Wow.
But yeah, there's just too many new infringers popping up every day. And so I see this as being a problem for a very long time. And, you know, counterfeiting's a multi-thousand year old industry. It's going to continue to kind of shape shift and change its forms. And so, yeah, I mean, what we are doing is we're helping the brands that we can do cases for. And so we're doing our best and we're trying to target as many counterfeiters as possible.
Nice. But. And I did a post about this and I had dozens of people reach out and say like, hey, introduce me. And I introduced a bunch of people to you guys, because I think the service is people do not know it exists and it's really a no brainer. There's a few things that are just a no brainer. Like, why would you not do this? And could you explain, like, if you're going to get ready to do this kind of thing, I know, for example, we had to go and register a lot of our copyrights in this process. Like, what are some best practices to do? Like, let's say someone's working with you or they're thinking of working with you. What things should they do now just to kind of prepare, you know, to fight infringers overseas?
Well, the most important thing is that they have registered intellectual property. So if you don't, that's okay. We can help you with that. We do it at cost. So if you don't have your images registered with the Copyright Office, it's very cheap to do. So register your IP, get it registered. And then the next thing is if you really want to stop your counterfeiters, do not just try to submit takedowns to the marketplaces. Because what that really does is it's just a slap on the wrist to the counterfeiter. You know, they basically laugh like, wow, I had to edit my listing, but I kept thousands of this brand owner's money. And so what you really want to do is gather, either work with a company like mine or do your own evidence gathering and really document the infringement, record all of the evidence and information about the counterfeiters, because you know, you're going to need that in order to sue them and win the lawsuit. If you're just submitting takedowns and the counterfeiters are editing their listings, and over time their listings are barely infringing, you know, the infringement's very weak, you're going to have a competitor who you can't stop and isn't really using your IP. So I think the solution is to, as early as possible, stop them when the infringement is as strong as it is, and collect money from them. I think that's the true way to deter counterfeiters, not just kind of slowly over time chip away at them.
Yep. And let's say the process takes, let's say, a year and a half. In a case it's a year and a half, how far into that does the freezing of the accounts occur?
Oh, that's a great, great question. Probably within, at least with our process, within 3 months, the listings that are infringing get taken down. Okay. And the assets are freezed just about right when that happens as well. So the marketplace receives a court order. Amazon will get something that says, okay, here are these 150 product listings, take them down and freeze the money that's in the accounts of those sellers that were on those listings.
Wow. And it takes, so that other nine months, 12 months, whatever it is, that is negotiating, them coming to their attorneys, they're doing this, coming back. And of course, over time, like one person settles, they get their account back, they get their funds released. And then do you do that directly with the marketplace, or do you have to go to the judge and the judge has to say something?
Well, with the settlements happen outside of the court. So, you know, you sign an agreement, the counterfeiter sends you $5,000, and then you just tell the marketplace, hey, we're all set, unfreeze that guy's account.
Okay, so you guys, because you, either way, you said, hey, I have this court order to freeze it. So you're the one freezing it, so you could also unfreeze it.
Exactly. The marketplaces will only listen to the plaintiff and only what the plaintiff has obtained with the judge's permission.
Okay.
So, and then, you know, there's a lot of time spent where you get that judgment against the counterfeiters, and then you have to send it to Amazon and say, hey, Amazon, we have a judgment against these 45 guys. Please give us the money in their accounts. And it takes, you know, a couple of weeks for them to do that. They've got a lot of other things they'd rather do in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what is the biggest case that you've ever done to date?
Mm-hmm. Let's see. In 2018, we sued almost 2,100 counterfeiters. And in that case, we collected $3.4 million.
Total. OMG. Mm-hmm. That is ridiculous.
Another one you might like is our biggest settlement with a single defendant one time was for $2 million.
No, 2 million bucks.
Yeah, that works out to willful counterfeiting, like in terms of the statutory damages. So, yeah. Wow.
And that was what? Is that a person they just sold millions and millions of units of something, or just millions and millions of dollars, and mm-hmm. you had proof of it? Or why did they settle that way? Did they just then go and keep selling a product in a different way to not counterfeit, or how was that able to occur with a single person?
Mm-hmm. Tens of thousands of sales, and the product was identical. I'm saying, you know, it infringed on every type of intellectual property the customer had. I don't want to go into it because I'll reveal
don't reveal it, but it's also a trademark as well.
Right. Yes. So
it's a real counterfeit. In this case, they actually produced a product with someone else's name on it.
Exactly. And the packaging was the same. The brand owner's names, company was on there. I mean, it was almost identical, except for we, let's just say, took it apart and opened it up, and only the internals were slightly different.
Wow.
So, Yeah, I mean, that's uncommon, that kind of amount of money for a single defendant.
Yeah, extraordinary. Extraordinary in terms of the amount. And probably, again, I don't know, but if someone settled with that amount, they could have still made more than that in their operations.
That's right.
Right? I mean, you don't know how much they made, really.
We just know how many sales occurred on the product listing that we caught.
Right.
And we didn't go to discovery because we had, you know, $2 million offer and and they stopped. They really did stop infringing from that point
on. That's amazing. Now, did that person go and make like a different product with like a different name and change it up a little bit and kept going? Probably. I'm assuming, but I don't know.
They didn't, but we do see that occasionally.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, after $2 million, I mean, you might say, hey, I'm not going to mess with these guys anymore. That's like a big slap in the face. Like, yo, get out of my face. You know, that's amazing though. Wow.
Well, on the other end, I don't encourage this at all, but some of my clients have had so much success stopping their counterfeiters. They've asked me, hey, like, what else can we do to get counterfeited? You know, and I tell them, you know, that's not something I'm going to help you with. That's not ethical. It always makes me laugh though. So,
well, I mean, in our case, the infringement was a pretty small amount compared to our total income. Right. I think the second case might be stronger, but it wasn't a significant, like it is a significant amount, but I guess in compared to our total amount, a total income, it's small enough in our case. And I don't know, maybe we just, the thing of how to get counterfeit is maybe you have more IP in terms of patents, or maybe a product is very, very unique. Like in our case, possibly, you know, we just had mostly copyright, but the more unique product you have, I think that's how you get more counterfeit. Right. I think that's my guess. That's my answer to your friends. Like, how do you get more counterfeit? You excel. Your products are more unique, more special, and you cannot have something similar unless you're counterfeiting, right? That is how you get more. And you obviously sell more and you get success more. And again, not with the intention to get more counterfeit, but that would be a side effect, which is typically a bad side effect. I guess, unless you get money. But I don't know. I don't think this is literally prevent losses and prevent people from screwing you over. I don't think this is a money-making really activity, as some of your clients may have thought.
Yeah,
about.
No, I don't wish for my customers to have a lot of counterfeiters, but I do wish to catch as many as possible and collect as much money from them.
Yep.
But you're totally right. The brands with the most sales or have their manufacturing in Asia typically get counterfeited the most. Less so made in USA products. But it does happen.
All right. And so let's talk about Molson and Brain Flakes. So about the Brain Flakes, is that product is not patented, correct?
It is now. He improved on a similar kind of design significantly. So it is utility. I believe it has a utility patent now on the way the cogs or the disc connect.
Well, that's amazing.
It's a really satisfying thing. I used to keep two Brain Flakes on my desk just because I like kind of putting them together. It's like a fidget thing. It has a good feel to it. It's like, have you ever put together some knockoff Legos that don't fit right or they sound creaky or whatever? So Vi-Hart did a great job of really improving the feel and connectivity of the product.
That's awesome. And so now you go after, hey, the patent, the trademark and the copyright. And I'm sure they're just repeating over and over and getting more and more counterfeits and taking it down. And like, I mean, obviously you guys co-founded this and I want to know how I can get the VIP treatment like Molson. I want to know how else can I get? How can I get more service from you guys?
Well, he has the VIP treatment because Edison does all his lawsuits for free. We don't take a percentage of those. But I mean, we treat our customers the same way. Everything that we can do for Molson's toy company, we do the same for our customers.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Excellent. All right. So we went over the process of, let me just recap here for people who are listening and whatnot is, hey, you have a brand, you have IP, you have images, you have a trademark, and you possibly have patents. So you have people overseas who are infringing, and it's pretty much a fact. Like, I don't know if you've made any amount of sales that are any significant. Like, if this is your main business, you will have counterfeiters. That's kind of how the world works. And so you go, they hire you guys, and your website is, give your website. Actually, you know, if you go to aaroncordovez.com/Edison, E-D-I-S-O-N, we'll have a little offer there and connect you guys over to Edison. Aaroncordovez.com/Edison, and connect with them there. And so they sign up with you, and you guys say, hey, you do an evaluation for free to say, this is how much counterfeits, this is all type of counterfeits. And you might even say, we might expect this amount of money. Do you give them like an estimate of how much you think you'd get back, or you guys don't do that?
We do, because we've sued 50,000 counterfeiters at this point. So we can tell them, hey, you know, historically, based on the marketplaces or similar types of products, we can estimate it.
Okay. So you say, okay, here's your estimate. And then you guys go ahead, and it's in a year to a year and a half or so, people will get back. And again, I guess a small case might bring you a few thousand dollars, $10,000, $20,000, something like that. And then the bigger cases, of course, go for hundreds of thousands. But if it's successful, the person will get money, and they essentially, their job, the part that they have to do is register any copyrights that they want to file against, because a lot, most people don't just file their copyrights. So they have to file their copyrights.
We can do that.
Yeah, you guys help with that. And then they have to basically, what do they have to review and kind of say, like, yes, these are all images or no? Like what does the seller have to do actually? Because I mean, I've done it, which is basically.
The only thing we ask is that the brand owner or our customer reviews the list of people that we're going to sue and can, you know, especially verify that they're not a distributor or customer of theirs, or, you know, sometimes our customers' manufacturers counterfeit them. And they like to get a, you know, advance notice before we go and sue their manufacturer. Maybe they work it out on the side on their own. So that's really it. I mean, we, of course, let the brand owner review everything we submit to the court, and we won't submit anything without their approval. But that's really the, besides a few questions at intake, the only thing we ask the customer to do.
Nice. So for very few hours of time, you go ahead and take back a bunch of money. You guys split it. You pay the law firm, and then you guys split basically what's left between the brand owner and you guys. Does that sum it up pretty well, what you guys do?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I just want to point out that if we're not successful, if we can't obtain the court order, there's no cost to the brand at all. Edison would lose some money, but we've actually never had a lawsuit where we didn't obtain what's called the temporary restraining order, the critical legal order that helps us freeze funds and remove counterfeits. So we just won't take a case unless we think we're going to be successful. And so, you know, we try, there's basically no risk to doing this. We won't do a case that we won't win.
Awesome. Brilliant. And then are these guys afraid of you now? Like, do you know, is there like a little like counterfeit guys, and they're like, dude, we have to take this Edison guy out. Like how, what have you heard from people or from defendants? Like, dude, are they scared of you or what?
So we don't, the counterfeiters don't know about Edison at all, because we don't put our name on any of the legal documents. We don't stamp anything or anything like that. So what the counterfeiters do know is that if someone's represented by one of the 8 law firms that we work with, they're going to have a bad time. So there's a Chinese based blog website called Seller Defense. So the website's sellerdefense.cn. Uh-huh. And all they do is, after the money gets freeze, they put up a, cause it's a surprise freeze, they put up a blog post and they say, everyone, like, you know, you're on the list, your funds have been frozen, this is what you should do. Like, you know, so they're definitely scared, but they try to coordinate, which is good for us. We don't have to go into that. Yeah, I mean, they know that they're going to lose money when that kind of legal strategy targets them.
Wow. Wow. And so, so the negotiation is done by the law firm, those 8 law firms, to the defendants. I mean, the and you said you kind of talked to them or whatnot, but it's really the lawyer or the attorney is doing the negotiating, or no?
That's right. The lawyer's doing the negotiating. We wouldn't use a law firm, but we're not an attorney. We're not law firm. We're not a law firm. And we don't want to cross the lines of practicing law. Right. And so, you know, with respect, of course, talking to the judge at a hearing or negotiating with the defendant's lawyer, you know, it's best that we leave that to an actual lawyer or their law firm. But we really do attempt to do everything else. And that's why the law firms that work with us are willing to do these cases on just the 20% contingency fee. And they're also willing to do these cases on contingency because they know that with Edison involved, we're going to guarantee that the case will be successful and make a lot of money.
Right. And so how can you, do you know how the negotiation goes? Because like, I guess Alibaba or Amazon, they turn over how many sales that person has done, or no, do they tell you?
They do. Yeah. So part of the court order that we get requires the marketplace to tell us how many units were sold, how much money is in the counterfeiter's account, and their contact information. So the brand owner's law firm reaches out to all the counterfeiters and says, hey, our opening demand is this much. We know how much you counterfeited. We know how much is in your account. You know, let's come to a fair agreement here.
And so, I mean, I guess they all come to a settlement, but like, really, let's say a margin of product. I don't know. Let's say it's selling a cookware, right? And maybe that cookware is a high price and you know the margin is 40%. So they sold $1 million and you're like, yo, you guys should need to give us 400,000. And what if they just go, no, we're only going to pay you 20 grand, you know, like right. You say, okay, well then stay frozen. And then we're going to go to the judge or what, how does that work?
Right. Yeah. The plaintiff and their attorney needs to decide, do we want to accept the 20,000 or do we want to try to collect whatever's in the seller's account? And if you do obtain a judgment against the seller, Amazon's policy and the other marketplaces is to shut down the account when there's a judgment over it that is unpaid and there's no response.
So, okay. So at the beginning, after the 3 month mark or so, it's frozen, but they're still operating. They just can't get paid.
Exactly. Oh. If they don't settle, they lose the money in their account and their account is shut down. So there's a lot of leverage there.
Wow.
Right.
And so who decides the settlement amount and whatnot? Like, so let's say, oh, it's like, I don't remember particularly doing this, but like, hey, will we accept this much from this person? I might just want to say no, like they need to pay us more or you let them get shut down. Like, I don't remember being a part of that, but I don't know. You said plaintiff. So I guess, that would have been us, no?
Yeah. So in our agreements and the law firm's agreements, we put in there a formula that says we have your pre-authorization to accept settlements above a certain amount. Okay. So on the low end, it's $1,000 plus your lost profits. So if we can't get you a settlement that high, I think the law firm may have contacted you a few times to get your authorization to settle for below that amount. And sometimes it makes sense too, if there's not very much frozen in the accounts of the defendant, or they only sold one or two units that we can prove, it can be a little unfair to ask for someone to give you $1,000 if there was, you know, $10.
No, I'm talking about like the case I'm thinking of is, let's say they sold $1 million, right? And you assume their margin is 40% on that. And they're not coming even 10% of what you believe their profit was, right?
Like you obtain a default.
Yeah.
You obtain a default and you shut down their account.
Right. And then at that point, do people get shut down and then they settle? Or normally they get shut down, you just take their account and they're going to go and make a new account or whatever?
Yeah, it's a little more rare. Sometimes people need to see that their account got shut down and they lost the money. And then they come back and what that's called is they vacate the judgment. They basically tell the judge, sorry, I was only emailed about this. I'm in China. I don't speak English. And so then we'll settle with them. But, you know, they won't be able to regain their store without a fair settlement.
Right.
So.
Okay, cool. Excellent. Well, Hilton, I really appreciate you coming on. Again, aaroncordova.com/Edison, E-D-I-S-O-N. You guys can connect it up. Really, I believe any brand who has any sort of revenues, any profit, you're doing anything, try and work with Edison. If they take your case, they will help and make you money. Now, I know also people have come and tried to do this. Last question. What if someone wants to do this themselves? They just want to go to a law firm and say, I'm going to work with a law firm directly, not with Edison. And like, have you had people do that? And like, why not? Why couldn't someone just do that?
Some people, they just want to work directly with the law firm. And I can understand if they want like very close control of the lawsuit. But it's going to be very difficult for you to do that with, you know, hundreds of counterfeiters. And then on top of that, the law firm that you work with is not really going to know how to like properly work with the third parties. There's a lot more that goes into actually getting like Amazon, eBay, Wish, AliExpress to comply with the lawsuit, get you the data you need in the timeline that the judge wants, and things like that. The law firm might not know how to negotiate with, you know, foreign-based counterfeiters. So I don't recommend that. It's risky. I've seen someone, we actually had to take over a lawsuit from someone that tried to do it without us. And then They came to us and they were like, can you fix this, please? But we, because they tipped off the counterfeiters and they kind of like screwed up their case a little bit, like it was even difficult for us to like kind of recover the case and have it be successful. So yeah, I mean, I wouldn't do surgery on myself. I wouldn't do my own heart surgery. I wouldn't sue hundreds of counterfeiters, you know, without an expert either. So, and I mean that. I'm not just saying that because that's what we do.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And then have you seen other competitors come in and try to do what you're doing?
No, you know, some of these software companies, like Redpoints, they pretend that they collect money from their customers. But I've spoken to many current and former Redpoints customers and they don't actually do that. So yeah, there's not a lot of people doing, not a lot of companies doing this. There are some law firms that try, but what they do, because they don't have the scale and the technology that we have, is they focus on just like the top 10 or the top 50 juiciest, best counterfeiters, and then they leave the rest. But at least with our customers, that's not sufficient because you're leaving up tons of counterfeiters. It doesn't matter if they're not selling a lot of product. You just don't want people to search your brand name and see fake product.
Yeah, because you take out the top guys and maybe the other ones pop up higher too.
Right.
That could be. Okay, cool. So, hey, where do people find you or find Edison, like get updates if they want? I don't know if you guys have a newsletter or anything. How do people connect with you and or Edison generally?
Mm-hmm. The best way is to just submit a form on our website. And our website's Edison LF, as in litigation financing. So it's edisonlf.com. And if you'd like, you can email me directly. It's just my initials, hh@edisonlf.com. And we're happy to review your infringement and make a recommendation as to what we could do.
Sweet. Brilliant. Brilliant. All right, brother. Well, I appreciate you coming on and thank you for all these insights and thank you for putting in the law and getting people to know that, guys, the law is there to be followed and it's there because, guys, you could create your own firm. Take that. I have a message to like any person who's, you know, listening to this, if they are counterfeiting, like, take that same effort and go and make a product that's unique and you'll probably have great success. Like, really, like, just do it. And I, when we started on Amazon, I didn't know copyright law and stuff. And I read Amazon's terms of service where it said, like, if you upload an image, you give Amazon and its associates a right to use it. And I'm like, well, I'm an associate of Amazon, so I'll take my competitor's image and use it. I've done that, you know, and then I got shut down and I was like, oops, I guess I shouldn't be doing that. Like, but instead, when you go and you make something for yourself newly, you actually have generally much more success. So anyway, guys, you don't need to counterfeit, but I appreciate you, what you're doing. And, all right, guys, that was Hilton Hart with Edison, and, get your money from counterfeiters. Don't wait. That's all I got.